Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. It was another jam-packed week. And this week, first of all, when it came to trading, we did wrap up the month of August, Tim, marking the seventh consecutive monthly gain for U.S. stocks, despite so much going on domestically and in the world.
Chief among them, Carol, was a week where the U.S. officially wrapped up operations in Afghanistan, a process that has left thousands of Afghans seeking refuge in the U.S. This coming nearly 20 years after the United States first invaded the country after September 11th. We're going to talk all about that with Jean-Aimé Desmarais, the Senior Director of U.S. Emergencies at Save the Children, and what the organization is doing to help those refugees, half of whom are children.
Now, Afghanistan, as Tim mentioned, definitely on our minds this week. So too was China, which continues to increase oversight on companies, industries, investing, and its kids. Every day, Tim, it felt like China was coming out, regulations were coming out from Beijing about another crackdown on some other aspect of their economy.
We got into that with Bloomberg New Economy editorial director Andy Brown, who wrote about the billions that Chinese tech leaders are shelling out in a sign of solidarity. We're going to hear from him in a bit. And the thing about Andy is there's pretty much no better voice to talk to about this, given his experience living in China for so many years. All of that to come in our first hour of Bloomberg Business Week. And if you check out the cover of Business Week, you're going to see it's a special double issue. And Carol, it is all about cities.
Exactly. And I love the cover. It says, "Welcome to Utopia," and then in parentheses, "in theory." And so that really speaks to the cover story, which is a story by our Joshua Brustein. We're going to hear from him a little bit later on. And he writes about e-commerce legend Mark Lurie, who's got a plan for the perfect city, but now he's got to actually take those words and put them into action. Not so easy.
Not so easy. Mark Lurie is a fascinating guy. If his name sounds familiar, because 5 or 6 years ago, you saw him on the cover of Bloomberg Business Week when he launched Jet.com. That company ultimately getting acquired by Walmart a few years ago for more than $3 billion. Lurie, before that, was the founder of Diapers.com, a company that he sold to Amazon for hundreds of millions of dollars. And now he's got his sights set, Carol, on creating this utopia. Unclear where exactly it's going to be, but he's had this realization of late that this is what he wants to focus on.
For a bit more, though, on this week's Double Cities issue, let's catch up with the Washington, D.C. editor behind it all. Here's Amanda Coulson Hurley.
This is a great cover story and just a great story about how Lurie, like a lot of other people in the tech world, has gotten the city building or city planning bug and really has this vision of not only building this city from scratch that would eventually have 5 million people, but structuring it on the economic ideas of Henry George, who was a thinker in the 19th century. And in the process, the city, in Laurie's vision, would kind of save capitalism from itself. It would, reduce inequality and produce a society, an egalitarian society. He's not, and he admits in the story, he's not super clear on the details yet, still working through a lot about how this city would be governed, even where it would be located. They're looking at sites in the American West, but it's not even clear what state it would be in.
I got to tell
he's hired a team, an architect, and he's pretty serious about it. Yeah.
You know, Amanda, I think we talk about the importance of public-private partnerships. This feels like a public-private partnership, ultimately on steroids, leaning more towards the private. So it's curious. We'll have to see where it goes.
You know, this one hit really close to home, a third story that I want to talk about in the city's issue.
Could tuning you turn off the city, please?
I know. Sometimes I'm on the phone with my parents or something or friends, and I'm like, I got to just call you back because there's an ambulance right here. There's a highway right here. There's some person screaming right here.
The normal noise, din.
How do you make cities quieter and therefore increase quality of life? Because people want to live in them, sometimes regardless of how loud they are.
Yeah, that's right. And this we have this great essay in the issue about sound in cities. And it kind of starts with the fact that cities did get somewhat quieter during the pandemic. And yet noise complaints, largely did not decrease, which tells you something, right? In that a lot of the time people weren't commuting into work. They were staying at home. And then their neighbor turns on a leaf blower or something, and you think, okay, it's going to be so much quieter in the suburbs or, in a residential neighborhood than in Times Square. And that's not really the case, or perhaps it's quieter, but, that neighborhood noise is every bit as annoying, if not more so. So our writer, Fergus O'Sullivan, tried to kind of dive into what it is about urban noise that bothers us or pleases us the most. And kind of found that, often it's not just about the volume. It's, it's about the kind of overall effect. It varies a lot from place to place.
That was the Washington, D.C. editor behind it all, Amanda Colson Hurley.
And check out the city's issue. Lots of stories there. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, on newsstands, and also on the Bloomberg terminal. Still ahead, though, on Bloomberg Business Week, you have seen those horrific images of the people of Afghanistan as they struggle to get out of the country amid the U.S. withdrawal this week.
100,000 were able to get out with the help of the United States, and many of those now seeking refuge.
Well, we're going to get into how that's happening, some of their stories. That's coming up next.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This past week was filled once again with tough images of the evacuation of Afghanistan, a crisis situation that involved the airlifting of 5,500 Americans and 100,000 Afghans.
Those Afghans are now taking shelter in countries around the globe, thousands here in the United States. Save the Children is among the organizations helping out. For more on the work they're doing, Carol talked with Jeanne-Aimé Desmarais, the Senior Director of U.S. Emergencies at Save the Children.
I am out at Dulles Airport providing services and supports, particularly to the young children and the new mothers who are coming through, working inside the airport, providing safe places for women, private places for women to be able to nurse and also change diapers. Many of the children have been traveling for more than 30 hours, and you can imagine sitting in the same diapers that whole time. They have severe diaper rash, and so they really need support when they're getting off the flight.
Right, and from what I understand that, there are so many that are kids, about half of them, is that correct?
From what we've been seeing, absolutely. And many of them are young children, so mm-hmm. very, very vulnerable children. The families have taken an incredibly long flight and been evacuated, as I'm sure people have seen on the news. It's about a 15-hour flight then to Dulles here in Virginia. Families then have to come into the airport. They're processed through Customs and Border Protection, which has been taking a number of hours. They then proceed upstairs where they're tested for COVID. And in that large lounge where all the families pass through, that's where we have our first mother and baby areas. For many families, when they get to that space, it's the first time they've been offered any food, water, relief in hours, many, many hours.
We're talking with Jeanne-Mae Desmarais. She's Senior Director of U.S. Emergencies at Save the Children with us from Washington, D.C. Jeanne-Mae, one of the things that I find at situations like this, times like this, is that one needs to get beyond those big, broad headlines and understand that underneath all of those headlines are people, families, children, individual stories. What can you share with us about some of the people that you are helping, some of the personal stories? As you said, a lot of them, the kids in particular, half of these refugees have been kids so far. Most of them are coming not wearing shoes, without any bags. Help us put some faces on these individuals.
There was a father who was watching his three beautiful little girls do some coloring in the space. And he was a very tall, proud man, and of course wearing a COVID mask. But he turned to me and his eyes just welled up with tears. And he said, "I was a translator at the U.S. Embassy. I had a good life in Afghanistan. I had a car and a house, which are a big deal to have in Afghanistan. And he said, I have nothing now. I don't know what I'm going to do. I have to start again. I have nothing." And I was like, I told him, "You have your beautiful girls and you are welcome here in the U.S. And that was just one moment. And then if I may share another one,
please.
A beautiful moment at the Philadelphia airport. Again, another family, they were about to board the bus to go out to Fort Dix. And one of the soldiers who was there, who's helping staff up the site, looked at the last man who was there with his family. It was the last person in line to get on the bus. And the soldier gave the man a big bear hug. And the man smiled and just hugged back. And the soldier said to the man, "Welcome to America. You're going to love it." And it was just this beautiful moment of smiles and welcome to people who have suffered incredibly on their journey to get here. And they've arrived here with hope for safety and security, but also hope for a better life now here in America for their families.
You know, I do think that when it comes to the Middle East, we tend to group all the countries together, all of the situations together. And there's obviously different situations, different countries, different relationships that the U.S. has with various regions within the Middle East. But it's also a reminder, and you're helping us be reminded of that, that it's not just soldiers and terrorists and war, but it's people who were prior to this living a quote unquote normal life and a good life.
Absolutely. And that also a very troubled life, because the country has been at war a long time and conflict is deadly for women and girls and children, especially. They're the innocent ones in these conflicts. And so for us as a country to now be receiving thousands of Afghan children who will be able to become contributing members here and be a part of the, you know, be a part of our country now is kind of what we're all about and what we were founded on years ago. But it's beautiful to see the reception that they are receiving both here at Dulles and also in Philadelphia at the airport and at all of the military bases where they're arriving or being sent in order for their visas to be processed. Save the Children is also working out at Fort Bliss, which is by El Paso, Texas. Mm-hmm. That's one of the largest receiving sites. They'll have about 10,000 of the refugees there while they're waiting for their visas to be processed before they can be safely released into the U.S. And we're there, again, operating programs for children to keep them safe, to help them start to learn English, to help them, again, be children and come back to being what a normal experience is. I know schools across the U.S. are starting now, and children here have traditions as they start, and these children are starting to build their traditions in the U.S. in the days ahead.
Tell us what happens once they've settled. You've talked to us about helping them get settled. They obviously have to get processed, as you mentioned, through customs, border protection, get visas, obviously some basic supplies, and then transferred, as you said, to a transit shelter. What are the next steps for them? How are they then assimilated into U.S. society?
Well, they will, from the transit shelter, they're then sent to the military base. They'll be there for the next, they're predicting the next month or 6 weeks, sometimes a little bit longer. During that time, they're trying to establish programs on the bases that will help them start to begin to learn about life here in America and help them with that assimilation process. And then they will travel on. Many of them have family or have worked for employers in the who have a presence in the U.S., they'll be moving on to communities across the country and will start to contribute. Once they get their visas and their work permits, they'll be able to start to contribute in our communities to being a part of who we are as a country.
That's Jeanne-Mae Desmarais, the Senior Director of U.S. Emergencies at Save the Children.
Coming up, we head to Beijing, where China's President Xi continues to make his mark to create a common prosperity for his country.
And in the process, Chinese tech billionaires, well, they're forking over billions to show their allegiance. That story still to come on Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So, yeah, another round of headlines out of China this week as the government and regulators continue to crack down on aspects of their society with a goal of creating, in the words of Chinese President Xi, a common prosperity.
Those moves this week included China limiting online gaming by minors to 3 hours a week, China's securities regulator planning to rein in the country's buyout firms, and China threatening to ban e-commerce companies that violate IP laws.
And Tim, that's just a few of the headlines that came out of Beijing this week. With all of this in mind, we checked in once again with Bloomberg New Economy editorial director Andy Brown, who recently wrote about what wealthy tech entrepreneurs in China are doing to show solidarity with the Chinese government.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is political theater of the highest order. President Xi Jinping, as you say, is on a campaign to promote common prosperity. In doing so, he's reviving the Maoist era spirit of egalitarianism. And the country's billionaires have got the message, and they're coughing up billions of dollars, something like $13 billion just in the last few months handed over to charity. Great if you're looking at your billionaires and your most dynamic Chinese companies to hedge their political risk. If you're a shareholder, perhaps you're not quite so happy.
Andy, is this the Cultural Revolution 2.0 in some ways?
Look, a lot of this is about politics. And, you know, during the Cultural Revolution, people in China feigned compliance. They didn't really mean it. There's a penalty to be paid in China today if you go against the party line. And the line now is egalitarianism. And this means really an assault on the private sector. And that's really where the problem comes from, because so much of China's inequality is baked into the system. It's baked into their taxation system. But it's the billionaires, the private sector, that are paying the price for this.
Well, okay. So, you know, every time you and I talk, I think about, you know, President Xi and what the end game is. Because on one hand, right, they do long-term planning. China does as a country, as a nation, as a government. And they have been very open about wanting to dominate, you know, major industrial sectors. At the same time, some of what they are doing feels like they're pushing back on the ability to do that in capitalism. Can they do both? Can they be leaders in industries?
It's a really good point, Carol. I mean, China is playing by a different set of rules here. Mm. This is not capitalism, where the purpose of a corporation is to maximize shareholder value. What companies in China are being told now is that your purpose in life is to fall into line and support government policy when it comes to technology, when it comes to the economy, and also social and political objectives. So we saw that with this announcement that online gaming companies were going to have to drastically limit the number of hours that kids spend in front of their screens, 3 hours a week. This is a bid to fix a social problem in China, and companies are expected to take the lead. And it doesn't matter the impact on their profits, or indeed, and especially not, the impact on foreign investors. It's simply peripheral.
So are they putting at risk their ability to be a global leader going forward, one that's respected by global investors, global business? You know, I'm trying to understand kind of what the end game. I mean, I understand the idea of spreading out the wealth and making sure that there's no upheavals within China itself. But I do wonder about what the future role is then as a nation.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're the Communist Party, every nail looks like it needs a hammer. And they're going about this in a really draconian, peremptory way. I mean, the problems that they're addressing in China are similar to problems elsewhere in the world.
Right.
I mean, inequality in China is about the same as inequality in the United States. The difference is that, you know, the way they've decided to go about this is to scapegoat the country's leading entrepreneurs, including Jack Ma, of course, who is the biggest and the most powerful of them all.
And that was Bloomberg New Economy editorial director Andy Brown. Be sure to check out Andy's weekly column at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, he talks with everybody, and those conversations have led to another book, this one about the American experiment.
And by everybody, we really mean everybody. The innovators making and remaking the United States, as told to Carlyle Group co-founder and host of Bloomberg Wealth, David Rubenstein.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
So, Tim, let's be fair. He talks with all kinds of leaders from all walks of our U.S. lives, of our global lives, really. The household names, the executives, the innovators, the warriors, the upstarts, the artists. And from those conversations, he has written a trilogy of books.
Those books on leadership called How to Lead, Wisdom from the World's Greatest CEOs, Founders, and Game Changers. The second, though, The American Story. It's based on his conversations with historians. And the third in the series, just out, is all about the arc of the United States as a young country as it invented and reinvented itself in real time.
And that book's title, Tim, it's called The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. The conversationalist, philanthropist, and author behind it all, David Rubenstein. He is co-founder, co-chairman of the private equity firm The Carlyle Group. He's also host of Bloomberg Wealth on Bloomberg TV and Bloomberg Radio. Here's our conversation.
Well, generally, I like to talk to people who are willing to say something. As you know from being an interviewer, if you watch the Sunday talk shows, sometimes you say, why do these people go on these shows? Because they don't really want to say anything. What you want is somebody who's willing to say something and say something they haven't said before. That's the best interview, right? And so I'm always looking for somebody who is willing to be engaging and doesn't want to just spar with the interviewer and not say anything. So, you know, it's a challenge, but that's what I'm trying to do. And you always want somebody that people will listen to and want to hear. So if I got an engaging guest, but nobody's ever heard of that person, it may not be as effective. If you can get Jeff Bezos, you know that's what people want to hear from him. So
right.
So you want somebody who has a name and who's willing to engage. And some people are great and some people are not as great. And, you know, you just figure it out during the interview.
But we think about what's happened with the pandemic, the Capitol riots, the inequities, George Floyd. We could go on and on. It feels like a decade or two decades of history have happened in the last year and a half. How has that, David, shaped kind of your thinking and putting this book together? And again, the voices you wanted to get to.
Well, each one has a different thing. Take the January 6th event. I do talk about it extensively in the book. And I basically say, it was a severe stress test for America, and America won. And I dedicate the book to the public servants who protect our democracy. Because remember, we had 65 lawsuits that were filed to overturn the election, and none of them actually prevailed. None of them got very far. All the judges basically complied with what is the rule of law, and they basically didn't act political. So I think we learned a lot about the importance of the rule of law in this country. We also learned a lot in terms of the importance of healthcare in this country, how it's so unfair that people of a minority status or are poor really were suffering disproportionately because of COVID, because they don't have good healthcare to begin with,
right,
and they didn't have access to the best healthcare. And it's a sad situation. But it also made me think about this, my mortality. I'm 72 years old. And when you're 72, you had a chance of, you got this disease, that you could maybe not survive. And we now know that 65% of the people who went on ventilators didn't actually come back out of the ventilators. We were putting people on ventilators thinking it was helping. It wasn't. So we learned a lot about how to treat people. But suppose I had gotten this and I went on a ventilator, I probably wouldn't be here now. So I learned a lot about my mortality and thinking about it. And the result is I'm rushing to get more things done because I now realize, hey, life is very short and something bad could happen very quickly. And so that's been something that I've been thinking a lot about.
It's like the Hamilton, right? I'm running out of time.
Right.
That whole concept.
Well, as you point out in the book, the American experiment has been relatively short at this point. And I'm wondering if you could contextualize the way that you think about what happened over the last year and a half as to what extent it really stress tested us. Because you do make note of the judiciary essentially saving the United States, not the lawmakers. Because you do call out in the book the lawmakers, the senators and the members of Congress who voted to overturn the election. They are still in power right now.
Yes, and I know many of them. And privately, they will say to you, well, I had to do that, or I knew it wasn't going to really prevail. Sure, but many of these people are, I live in Washington. I host a series in front of members of Congress once a month. With COVID ending soon, hopefully I'll be resuming that. And I know a lot of members and so forth. And, you know, privately what they say is, well, I had to do this, and they didn't really believe in it, but, you know, and so forth. Some will say that. I'm not going to go say who said that. But clearly, it's a very political situation. It's just the saddest part of the whole situation we now face is that we've politicized the government so much so that the country's really unable to move forward very much. We have people who don't want to wear masks. who think that it's a good thing to force people not to wear masks, in effect. It's a sad situation in many ways when you think about it, that school children whose teachers want them to have masks are being told they aren't supposed to have that mask. So a bad situation, and people are dying because of this.
When did debate become like a bad thing? I thought that was what kind of the roots of democracy were all about, this whole idea of having different perspectives and hopefully talking it through and getting to a better place.
When I worked in Congress in the 1970s and in the White House, there were obviously political disputes all the time, and obviously this was after Watergate, but people thought eventually you got to get something done, and so you had bipartisan legislation. Now, if to be considered a great legislator, used to be you were good at bipartisan legislation, get people on both sides to work together. Now, to be a great legislator, you're probably somebody that is good in only getting your Democrats or your Republicans to support you. And members of Congress now spend so much time raising money because they want to raise money for their campaigns or to thwart anybody from challenging them. And they have to spend 40% of their time, in the case of members of the House, to raising money. And the money and the internet and social media has just divided the country in so many ways that I find it interesting when I host these dinners, many people say this is the most interesting thing that members feel they're doing in Washington. They can have a dinner when nobody sees they're meeting with somebody from the opposite party because there's no press there, and they can talk to people from the opposite house, which they rarely do because they rarely have conference committees anymore. It's, look, I also recognize this. Every generation, 10,000 years back and so forth, has always said, well, in my time it was better, and now it's not as good. Now, George Washington's father allegedly told him, well, your generation is not going to achieve anything because you guys are not hardworking or whatever. Well, the truth is every generation tells the younger people you're not going to be tough enough, you're not going to be surviving enough, and ultimately civilization goes forward. So sure, there are challenges now. I'm not happy with many things that have happened. One thing that did happen, though, during all this period of time is the George Floyd murder. In that case, the thing that struck me was this. I lived through the Civil Rights Revolution. We've lived through the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and so many things that have been done, affirmative action, other things. But this one murder crystallized for people in this country the fact that we are still discriminating in so many ways. Just think about it. All the people that have been lynched over the years didn't seem to have the same resonance as this one murder. Maybe because it was on TV, maybe everybody saw it, maybe because people saw it was so ridiculous the way it was handled. But we've made some progress, obviously, on racial relations. And I'd say in the book that while we've made a lot of progress on racial relations and gender equality and other things, we still have a long way to go. The rhetoric that is in the Declaration of Independence and the rhetoric in the Constitution is wonderful. Well, we've been spending 230 years trying to live up to that rhetoric, and to some extent we've made progress, and to some extent we haven't. And what I say in the book is that we have these genes. These genes are part of us, the belief in the rule of law, the belief in equality, the belief in the power of voting. And we've been trying to make sure that people kind of honor these things that are part of our genes, and sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. The rule of law is a gene that's so strong that it prevailed in the January 6th situation and the post-election fight, and I think that was good. In many other countries, had you had a leader do what was done here, I think you could have had a military takeover.
Let's talk about some of the conversations. Ken Burns, Madeleine Albright, right. Jill Lepore, who I don't know is necessarily a household name, Walter Isaacson, David McCullough, some of the things, Rita Moreno. Some of the conversations that stood out, and obviously they talked about very different topics.
The different topics.
But a common thread, I guess.
Well, Ken Burns talked about Vietnam, and it turns out in Vietnam, the political leaders knew all along. They knew all along that we had no chance of winning that war militarily. It was really a political exercise, which was disappointing because we lost 58,000 men and the Vietnamese lost millions of people. David McCullough did a wonderful job of explaining how nobody took the Wright brothers seriously in this country. They had to go to France to kind of prove that they could fly.
Another reason why we love France.
Right. So Rita Moreno is an incredible story, and a woman from Puerto Rico who was not taken that seriously as an actress because she was from Puerto Rico. She was given kind of Latina jobs, but she turned out to be an Academy Award winner, and she had an interesting life. She lived with a very famous person for quite some time, Marlon Brando, and I think 8 years or so, and then tried to commit suicide because he was unfaithful, and then she recovered from that and obviously went on to now win an Emmy, a Grammy, every other award, Tony, that you can win. So she's quite an impressive person now, still performing at age 88 or 89.
The investment environment, I don't know, whether it's SPACs, whether it's crypto, what's interesting to you right now?
Well, clearly crypto is something that gets a lot of attention. It's amazing how many people are interested in crypto-related
things. Are you invested
things.
In crypto in any way?
I have not invested in crypto currencies myself. I have invested in some companies that kind of service the industry. And my standard view on crypto is when you go to Las Vegas, most people are smart enough to know you're not going to win there. And if you spend more time there, you're certainly not going to win, but you enjoy it. You have the pleasure of gambling. So you pick 1 or 2% of your net worth and do that. Well, the same is true in crypto. Crypto, you want to speculate, you don't really know that much about it, try it 1 or 2 or 3%. It's not harmful, and you'll probably have an enjoyable time, perhaps. I interviewed for my show on Bloomberg, John Paulson recently, mm-hmm. and he is dead set against it. He just said, this is terrible, and it's going to zero. But on the other hand, I've interviewed some other people that'll come out soon who are going to be saying, hey, I think it's a way to make a lot of money. There's one person I'll be interviewing soon who's made billions of dollars in crypto.
That's David Rubenstein, co-founder and co-chair of the Carlyle Group. David, also host of Bloomberg Wealth on Bloomberg TV and radio. His new book, The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. Hear our whole conversation on our podcast feed.
That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Tim Stenovek.
And I'm Carol Masser. Ahead in our next hour, we've got the cover story of Bloomberg Business Week, the city's issue. It's about the diapers.com guy who wants to build a utopian megalopolis.
Plus, we hear from Rob Katz, the longtime CEO of Vail Resorts. We talk climate change, labor, and stepping down after 15 years as the chief executive.
We'll also check in with one of the early investors in Wheels Up. We'll talk about private air travel and his new investments in clean tech.
Plus, the director of the documentary Searching for Skylab. All that and more in the next hour.
This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a conversation with one investor, Tim, who's all in on campus housing, private air travel, also clean technology.
Plus, it's not quite ski season, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere, but it's just around the corner. The CEO of Vail Resorts, Rob Katz, joins us with an outlook and changes in the C-suite.
Also, the work they're doing with all of those California fires.
And the director of the documentary, Searching for Skylab, America's Forgotten Triumph.
First up this hour, let's get back to this week's special double issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's the city's issue. The cover story, it's about Mark Lori, who amassed a fortune building e-commerce sites. His latest mission, though, investing that money into building a privately run city. Lori shared his vision with Bloomberg Businessweek technology editor Joshua Brustein.
As you said, Mark Lori has had a successful career building e-commerce websites. First, he built the company that ran diapers.com, which he sold to Amazon, worked for Amazon for a bit, left and built jet.com, which was basically an Amazon competitor, which was bought by Walmart. He then ran Walmart's e-commerce division for about the last 5 years. But almost immediately upon getting to Walmart, he started talking to people about this plan to build a city from scratch, basically. His current plan is for it to have eventually about 5 million people. That would be 40 years from now, and obviously a lot would have to go right to get there. And he's just starting to lay some of the groundwork for what's a pretty audacious project.
Is it going to happen?
Historically, if you look at what other people who have had come up with similar plans like this, I think the answer would be no. There have been a really steady stream of these utopian city building projects over the years. I talked to a professor at McGill University who studies them and says that there's about 150 such projects underway right now. But she said she couldn't really point to a single one that had fully succeeded in its goals. Some of them do have some people, but they never quite get to the heights that they're aiming for.
Joshua, a few months ago, you got some time to really sit down with Mark Lori and really get his vision, which you lay out so clearly in the cover story of this edition of Bloomberg Business Week. What is it that motivates Mark Lori to do this? What is he concerned about? What is his thinking around this, the philosophy around this?
The thing that he's really interested in is this model of land ownership, which was first floated by an economist named Henry George in the 1900s, which is basically the idea that you could hold all of the land in a city in a trust, and instead of allowing people to own their own land, everyone would be leasing the land from this central trust, and the income from those leases could be poured back into social services. And now Lori thinks that this is a way to deal with inequality, which he professes to be his main incentive in trying to pursue this project. It was a little bit jarring to hear this from a guy as he sat in his $44 million penthouse apartment and explained it to me. But that is really what he seemed laser focused on.
It sounds like a really nice apartment, by the way.
It was a great apartment.
Okay.
What I will say is, and we're getting ready to talk with David Rubenstein, who has a new book out called The American Experiment. And it's, you know, conversations he's had as America has continued to evolve and innovate and change on some really important issues. And I do think we are at this critical juncture when we look at some of our cities that are struggling and have struggled so much in the last year and a half. And you do wonder what happens going forward. Will the infrastructure ultimately come from the federal government and maybe change some of those cities that have been struggling? You know, do we have an opportunity because we could work from home? We don't have to work in major cities to reinvent the cities and towns that we have out there. So, you know, as crazy as it might be, Joshua, like you do wonder, does Mark Lori maybe have something that maybe there are ways we can do things better?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of themes that come up in a number of these sort of technology-driven utopian city building ideas, which I think are rather valid critiques of the way that cities work now. I think Lori has correctly identified the fact that inequality is an enormous problem and is causing really a lot of strain on the capitalist system in the United States.
Right.
Also, if you have something like autonomous vehicles, you want to cut down on car use generally. These are big transformations of a city, and it's very hard to get things done in cities. They tend to really grind down due to inertia, politics. There's a lot of reasons why things can't happen. So I think that those are good diagnoses of the problem. Whether you'd be able to do something like that by starting anew, I'm not sure that's any easier. But it's certainly tempting to give it a try.
That was Bloomberg Business Week technology editor Joshua Brustein. And for more on the world's cities, including the reality of China's ghost cities, also Rochester's payphones, be sure to check out this week's special double issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. It's all about cities.
Remember payphones?
I do.
There are some people out there. My daughter doesn't.
Yeah, she like never interacted with them, right?
No, she's just kind of glued to her cell phone. All right, coming up, with two billionaires jetting up into space, you may be taking space exploration a bit for granted.
But there was a time when we were early in the game and needed to learn much more about Earth, space, and the sun. Enter Skylab, a documentary that tracks its voyage.
That's still to come on Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
2021 is definitely turning out to be a big year for space exploration. Tim, you know this firsthand. You were there in Texas when Jeff Bezos went up into space.
And he did go into space. He was the first person, along with a handful of others in the capsule that he was in, to go atop his Blue Origin New Shepard rocket. And then a few weeks before that, we saw Richard Branson go up in a Virgin Galactic's own version of that. We should note Jeff Bezos went quite a few miles higher. And many people say, at least according to the international definition of space, that he was the one who actually went to space.
Are we battling for the billionaires now?
I don't know. It's a good question.
In case you forgot, just here's a reminder, certainly after the two of them went up into space. We're just going to say it.
We've been to space, everybody.
Blue Control Bezos, best day ever.
Well, after the initial moon exploration came Skylab, America's first manned space station, which launched on May 14, 1973. Dwight Stephen Bonieski is director of a documentary on it. It's called Searching for Skylab, America's Forgotten Triumph.
Skylab, the best way I can put it is when I was a little boy, I was taken aback. I remember vividly watching Apollo 17 on the television. And since that point, I was fascinated by space. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to share this knowledge. And I've discovered about Skylab because it crashed into my homeland of Australia in 1979.
Yeah. Well, take us back then, because I do think that it is, I agree with you that it is America's forgotten triumph. When you think of space stations, people think of the International Space Station that is continuing to orbit right now. Take us into what happened with Skylab, especially with your interaction with it in the late 1970s.
Yeah, well, this is part of the reason why it's become a forgotten triumph, so to speak. I grew up thinking it was a failure because it crashed into Australia. And you know, it's the sort of thing I had the feeling people were like, oh, we don't really want to talk about that because it crashed. You know, let's move on. Let's forget about it. And being in astronaut conventions and so forth, I would see all the time the Apollo astronauts, the ones that walked on the moon, would have crowds of people come to them. The Skylabbers, you could stand there and talk to them for half an hour before somebody else would come along. And I thought, this actually outraged me. I thought, what these guys did up there was so fascinating. It helped us understand the planet. And they're being sort of pushed aside for the people that walked on the moon. And I thought, what they did is equally, if not more important, than what Apollo did. And I'm very biased, of course. I, in researching the film, changed my perception for thinking this is the thing that crashed into Australia this was a success right even up until the point that it crashed, because learning from people at NORAD who were telling me that what they learned from Skylab crashing set the benchmark for all the orbital analysis that they do now on spacecraft when they come back to Earth. And he said we couldn't pay for this information that we now know.
So Dwight, what do you make of what's going on right now with this kind of race to space with from private companies now instead of governments so many years later? What are your thoughts?
I think it's actually a good thing. I think it's exactly what space exploration needs. I liken it very much to how the aircraft industry went. In the beginning, it was a millionaires only club, pretty much. Now, anybody can get on a plane. I think that's going to happen with space travel as well.
I mean, would you do it? I bet you would.
I certainly would. Yeah. I have gone to Kennedy Space Center. I've seen the size of the Gemini capsule. If it's something like that, no way. I wouldn't even fit into the thing because I'm over 6 foot tall. So it's out of the question. But in principle, yes, I definitely would fly.
Hey, Dwight, I'm wondering about how you went about finding the interviews that you did for this story. Engineers and their families, those people who were eyewitnesses to it actually coming down in the Australian desert. Who did you interview and how did you get these interviews?
I just approached the astronauts and asked them point blank, the guys in Honeysuckle in Australia. I was involved back in 2009 for the search for the Apollo 11 telemetry tapes. So I got to know them through my work in assisting that research. And for family members and so forth, it was just shot out of the blue. Look, I know who you are. I think it's a tragedy that your parents are forgotten about because they flew up in space after Apollo. And everybody was just so enthused to be able to tell their story. I didn't have that much problem. The hardest thing in all of this was after making the film as an independent filmmaker, running out of money to be able to promote the thing. And that's where I had to get creative in learning how to market the thing. And I am so glad that Bloomberg had gotten wind of my creativity and decided to talk to me. So I am very indebted to you. Thank you.
Well, we are certainly eager to have you on the show. And I'm wondering what it was like to live on Skylab. What did you learn from the astronauts who you spoke to for the documentary?
We interviewed Paul White in what I believe was the very last interview he ever gave, which was an honor, bittersweet. And he said, and we have it in the film, he said, I never got tired of looking out the window. Mm. And I thought, wow, yeah. They were obviously very busy. You know, the time they had to sit in front of the window was allocated by the second, pretty much. But the fact that they could sit there and just take in this visual panorama of the Earth, or Jack Lousmore was saying when he did a spacewalk, he would see the ball beneath him and they're flying over it. And he was describing it like a magic carpet.
Wow.
And he said, this is something you cannot describe. And I believe him. You know, I've seen film of it and television downlink. It must be like standing at Grand Canyon. You can see photos, but until you stand at Grand Canyon and see it for real, no words can come close to describing how it really is.
Hey, Dwight, just in the last 30 seconds that we have, what is the next story about space you want to tell?
Apollo-Soyuz test project.
Yeah?
Where the Russians and the Americans met up, because that was significant in more ways than were made available in the time that it happened, when we think today cooperation between nations up in space is the standard, not the exception.
That was Dwight Stephen Bonieski, director of the documentary Searching for Skylab, America's Forgotten Triumph.
Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, we catch up with the outgoing CEO of Vail Resorts.
You know, one of the challenges that comes with climate change is weather, you know, variability, more intense variability. And we've seen this, whether it's, you know, with intense rains, by the way, it could be intense cold or intense snows during the winter, or intense heat, fires, drying. You know, we think that this is a global critical issue, an emergency.
Vail Resorts CEO Rob Katz joins us next. This is Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Last month, Vail Resorts announced succession planning, naming Kirsten Lynch, Vail's chief marketing officer, as CEO, effective November 1st.
As for the current CEO, Rob Katz, he will stay on as executive chairperson of the board. Katz checked in with us to talk about the changes, the business outlook, and what's next for Vail.
We began, though, with an update on the California fires and Vail's Lake Tahoe ski resorts. Check it out.
Clearly, you know, our number one priority is making sure that we're protecting everybody in those communities, everyone who's been evacuated, making sure we're giving them support, sustenance, you know, not only for our employees, but for anyone in those communities that in any way needs help right now. It's a very challenging situation. The fire is obviously doing significant damage. As of yet, it has not reached either Kirkwood or Heavenly, our two resorts in Tahoe, but it is close to both. And we are working closely with all the various agencies to do what we can to help minimize damage, particularly to the communities. That's obviously our number one priority right now.
Rob, when you see this play out, I mean, this is like, this is the visualization of climate change happening in real time. I know your company has been one that has for years talked about sustainability, focused on sustainability. After all, your business is dependent on it. What does it make you think of when you see this visual representation of it?
Yeah, I think it's something that we've been talking about for quite some time, which is that, you know, one of the challenges that comes with climate change is weather, you know, variability, more intense variability. And we've seen this, whether it's, you know, with intense rains, by the way, it could be intense cold or intense snows during the winter or intense heat, fires, drying. You know, we think that this is a global critical issue, you know, an emergency that requires global cooperation. Certainly our company is trying to do its part. We have a very proactive and bold commitment to zero, where we're going to, you know, essentially be a net carbon zero company by the year 2030. And we've been active in lobbying and pushing for better U.S. and global cooperation on this issue. I think the cost of doing our part for climate change is far outweighed by the benefit of mitigating some of these other costs that come from these natural disasters.
Do you think net zero is the way we need to think about it, or do we need to think about a way of not just being net zero, but actually doing something that improves the situation rather than just kind of being neutral?
Well, yeah, just to be clear, when we say net zero, what we mean is that we would reduce our carbon footprint to net zero from where it is today, and that would come from a combination of reducing our electrical and other fuel usage by, I think it would be 15%, I think, from last year. It would be, I think, something like 25 to 30% over the last 15 years, plus buying energy from renewable sources. So I think that is an approach that candidly could work around the world. I don't think we can, you know, reduce our energy use to zero, obviously, but I think we need to make a major reduction in our energy use and then also start shifting to renewable sources.
If your properties in Kirkwood and Heavenly, if they get lost to these fires in Tahoe, would you rebuild?
Yeah, at this point, I don't think, luckily the fire hasn't hit them, and, we're hoping for obviously minimal damage, and yeah, we will, of course, repair anything that's damaged as soon as we possibly can to get them, immediately open for guests, both during the fall and certainly for the upcoming winter, and at this point, we're very much focused on a terrific winter ahead.
Does climate change impact any of your strategy, or how does it get incorporated into Vail Resorts' kind of longer-term strategy and thinkings?
Well, I think that, as we talked about before, certainly our commitment around the environment and reducing our carbon footprint, of course, it starts with that. But from a business standpoint, it really is about advanced commitment and the season pass strategy that we've had over the last 15 years, which is really to get skiers and riders to purchase their skiing in advance of the season by giving them an incredible discount, an incredible value on the skiing. And I think, what's amazing is, our season pass price today is very much aligned with where it was about 12 years ago when we reduced prices 20%. and actually, of course, it's wildly below where it was right before we introduced the Epic Pass. And a lot of people look at that and they say, well, why are you doing that? And how could you make money doing that? And I think our strategy has been, we think if we give this incredible deal, one of the best deals in all of travel, to guests, that they will buy in advance. And that gives stability to both our company, to our ability to employ and invest in the resorts, and to our communities, right? So we think that it has been this stabilizing feature.
That was Rob Katz, CEO of Vail Resorts.
Coming up on Bloomberg Business Week, from wheels up to placing bets on ESG and campus housing, we check in with the investor who, Tim, is finding opportunities all over the place.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We like checking in with our next guest because he's involved in a handful of different sectors that are important to watch.
Among them, aviation, real estate, and of course, the financial markets. We're talking about David Adelman, who's the CEO of Campus Apartments, which manages more than $2 billion of on- and off-campus housing and real estate.
David, by the way, also the founder and CEO of Darko Capital. We began our conversation talking about private air travel.
It's two steps forward, one back, but a little bit of everything. I think, from the aviation perspective, we've talked about my involvement. I'm the lead director of Wheels Up, and I think, which is kind of the largest on-demand aviation company in the country. We just went public about a month ago, and, private aviation is obviously doing very well in this post-pandemic world.
And continuing to do well? You guys are continuing to see as much demand. I mean, the stock's down about 32%, a little bit of a hit so far since that. What can you tell us about demand there?
Demand is great. About a week ago, we reported really strong second quarter earnings about a couple weeks ago, and, really excited about the future there. And, private aviation, it's just become more effective, efficient, and accessible. And that's really what we're doing at Wheels Up, is kind of creating this marketplace where we can match up people with supply.
All right. So because I know we talked a lot about aviation and you saw a lot of people who maybe didn't do private aviation before really take advantage of it during COVID. That demand level is staying at what we saw during the pandemic, or is it going above that, or is it going a little bit below it?
No, it's definitely, you know, where it was and headed higher, to be honest with you. People are, you know, especially come spring, as people started making forward plans, you know, before the Delta variant about travel and getting out there a little bit and enjoying summer, we saw demand pick up.
Well, speaking of getting out there, I was on a college campus over the weekend dropping my daughter for the first time, and just hearing the president of the institution and others speak about how great it was to have kids back on campus because they haven't had them that way. Tell us what you're seeing, because you know, deal with on and off campus housing. What are you seeing?
So last week I was also dropping my daughter off. So same thing. And it felt great to do it. I think, you know, we mentioned, I think last time I was on, you know, during the pandemic, a lot of students still chose to kind of quarantine in their college apartment or dorm room, not wanting to live with mom and dad after maybe having experienced a brief time home. But, you know, it was online remote learning. I think now what you're seeing is the schools are opening back up. You know, we could certainly talk about those that are mandating vaccines, but, you know, they're masking up and they're back in action. And so I think it's healthy for these students to get back there with their friends and enjoy the college experience, which is, you know, more than just the education, you know, in the classroom, but the education of the self and making friends and doing all of that. So we couldn't be happier to have people back on campus.
Hey, David, you were talking about what you're seeing in terms of colleges. So kids are back. What's been the demand for on-campus, off-campus housing?
So the demand has been strong. Kids really wanted to get back out there, live in with their friends. And, you know, when you think from a COVID perspective, with the products we build are really kind of four-bedroom, four-bath units, so everyone has their own bedroom. It's not high density. It's, you know, very safe and effective from a COVID perspective. And we're seeing, you know, from an occupancy perspective, we're in the high 97-98% across our portfolio.
Is that unusual, you know, or is that pretty normal?
No, we're back to basically pre-COVID levels.
Okay.
And so I think the only dip you would find across the country is probably a little bit less international students who did not come back, and that's maybe a couple percentage points.
So what does that tell you? I think, you know, it's interesting. We did a story earlier. Let me just backtrack with our Steve Matthews about the metrics that we're using to really figure out what's going on in the economy and the impact that the Delta variant is having. So you were looking at hotel bookings, we're looking at airline miles being flown, we're looking at job opening postings. And a lot of those metrics are showing that things are slowing down again. How would you describe economic activity from the different lenses that you actually look at the economy through?
Yeah, I see it differently. From the businesses we're involved in, you know, obviously from real estate to aviation, we don't see the slowdown. We see the same trouble people are having in trying to get employees. That's certainly a challenge. But we definitely aren't seeing kind of the slowdown that you just mentioned.
Oh, you're not? Okay, that's interesting. Are there any concerns that things could start to roll back substantially? We've certainly seen companies rolling back and not bringing maybe some of their workers back to the office, putting that off for a few months or maybe even into next year.
Yeah, we're seeing kind of the people kind of like take the wait and see approach. You know, those companies that had announced kind of the post Labor Day back into the office, you're seeing them kind of do kind of a, you know, a little bit of a stutter step and saying, well, let's wait till October and see. And I think people are kind of just pushing it back, seeing how these boosters come into play. I know that's certainly how we're looking at things as well.
You sound pretty calm. So tell me a little bit about the investment environment right now, because, you know, you were one of the early investors in Wheels Up. We talked about that earlier. Where are you finding opportunities? There's a lot of money sloshing around in the economy, thanks to low rates, thanks to wealth creation for a big part of the U.S. economy. Obviously, the Fed easy policies help create some of the liquidity, a lot of liquidity in the marketplace. Where would you or where are you committing new money, and what new investments have you been making?
You know, interestingly, you know, you mentioned during right at the commercial break about, you know, the fires in California and a little bit about climate change and things like that. We've actually made a big push in climate tech companies. And, you know, what we're really looking to do is invest in companies that are reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you know, from software and hardware solutions. We've recently, in the last 90 days, invested in a handful of unannounced companies that are working on reducing methane emissions, a handful of decarbonization companies. And so we definitely see that as a trend in some place where we think you can. There was generally a shortage or a lack of capital because maybe people just weren't as into it. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking to put capital there.
What's changed in that? Because we've been talking about ESG, certainly, and climate change for a while. It does feel like in the last year and a half, and maybe it was seeing the world shut down and the skies clear up that made us realize, wait, we can maybe make a difference. We've talked about methane, the difficulties with that, but also how in a shorter period of time you can do some cleanup, serious cleanup of it. What do you think's changed in the investment mindset?
I think that what's happened is that you had the concept of ESG, which I think first started with like, hey, that's the do good, feel good. And then you have the commercialization, which then allows people to access it from a financial perspective. So that way you can kind of put your money where your mouth is versus just saying, I want to make a difference. You know, I'm going to recycle, or I'm going to, you know, do business with companies that are more, you know, responsible. And so I think, you know, there's been a bunch of founders, and, you know, even old, you know, founders who've been around, you know, Chris Sacca just launched, who hadn't been in the fund business in a long time, just launched a fund called Lower Carbon to, mm-hmm. you know, really tackle this, you know, where other people haven't really focused in a climate change fund, and he's doing it.
So before we go, one of the other investment areas that you've done is beverages. LeBron James, new tequila. I have talked with some celebrities, Nick Jonas among them, Sam Heughan, who's got a new whiskey of the Outlander fame. More and more getting into spirits. What is it that you find interesting in the beverage space, and what guides your investments there?
What's interesting about the beverage space is really kind of, to, you know, certainly during COVID, you know, consumption certainly went up. And I think creativity is going up. So, you know, one of our companies we're in is a ready-to-drink beverage called Vide. And what I liked about that is we saw beer sales declining over the years, and people want maybe a healthier option. And so this is a vodka-based kind of ready-to-drink beverage in a can. We just bought a organic vodka called American Harvest. And as we think about kind of, you know, that American spirit, it's made in Idaho, and you know, vodka is still the biggest spirit out there, but it's not as popular as people talk about tequilas, like the one we did with LeBron and Mav Carter and, you know, the other spirits that are out there. And so I think that the variety, people know what they want. They like the ability to have choice. And I think spirits is kind of finding its moment where people want to be able to have multiple options to choose from.
That's David Edelman, CEO of Campus Apartments and the founder and CEO of Darko Capital.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovic. Be sure to tune into our Bloomberg Business Week daily show Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
Also, check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And you can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great holiday weekend.
Stay safe. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh,
Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johan. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.